There's a compelling case to implement vocational training program that imparts hard skills and target these programs to high school dropouts, college dropouts, and unemployed vulnerable youths.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Instinctively, we might imagine that vocational training and apprenticeships would be an effective way to help young people find productive work, especially in large parts of the global south. But previous evidence to support this reasonable assumption has been weak, and a lot of researchers have found little or no effect. A chapter in the forthcoming Handbook of Experimental Development Economics reviews the most recent and the most rigorous studies to discover what they say about which programs work, what doesn't seem to work, who benefits, and who isn't benefiting. Subramani of Fordham University and Neha Agarwal of the University of Otago are the authors, and they join me now. Subha, hello.
Hi, Tim.
And Neha, hello as well.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having us.
Subha, we know that there is unemployment and underemployment in low- and middle-income countries. How common are these problems?
The unemployment problem is the typical joblessness problem in low- and middle-income countries. Unemployment rates are generally small here, only about 5% in low-income countries and about 6% in low- and middle-income countries. Even in sub-Saharan Africa, it's only about 3%, and that's because the poor cannot afford to sit idle.
Mm-hmm.
But the unemployment problem is quite acute among youth in these countries. Almost 15% of individuals between the ages of 15 and 24 are unemployed. I remember growing up in India, and I've seen this in other parts of the developing world as well. During the election cycle, almost every political party is going to promise a solution to the youth unemployment problem.
Of course.
So it's always been in the forefront. Let me now turn to the second problem, which is the underemployment problem in low- and middle-income countries. This is even more common than the unemployment problem because it captures working-age adults' willingness to work more hours, but they cannot find more work. So in a standard 5-day work week, suppose I wanted to work 8 hours a day, but I'm able to find work for only 4 hours a day, then my underemployment rate would be 50%. Underemployment is usually very high for those employed in the agriculture sector or informal sector, since only some part of the day can go into tending to the farm, caring for livestock, and a lot of time is available for more work, but there are very few opportunities to do work. These numbers are a little bit more difficult to come about, the underemployment rate compared to unemployment rates. But among low-income countries in sub-Saharan Africa, the underemployment rate is at about 30%, which is huge.
Yes.
But it's on the higher end of the prevailing underemployment rates in low- and middle-income countries.
I've seen this described as an epidemic of worklessness. If it is an epidemic, what's the long-term impact of it?
Yeah, there's been quite a lot of work in this area, especially by labor economists.
Yeah.
Worklessness can impact all areas of life, work, health, marriage, and also impacts the people who live around us. So let's start with the most direct effect of worklessness, which is on living standards. It depletes earnings in the short run. You lose your job, you lose your monthly income. The unemployment spell, especially in early stages of life, is then going to hurt your long-term wage prospects as well, which is sometimes referred to as scarring in the labor economics literature. And of course, once you lose job in the short run, it also increases your probability of being unemployed subsequently in later years. So joblessness has this persistent negative effect throughout one's lives. But joblessness also impacts different aspects of health. We now have a lot of evidence, especially the recent surge in discussion on mental health, that unemployment is linked to poor mental health. It leads to anxiety and depression. There's also some evidence that joblessness can increase alcohol consumption, drug use, and other substance abuse, especially among young men. Mortality rates are also higher among unemployed youth, especially suicides and accidents. Youth unemployment has also been linked to crime. For instance, Chris Blattman's work shows that providing employment deters high-risk men from committing crime. And of course, male employment is also good for all the wives. We've seen evidence that emerged during the pandemic that male employment can reduce domestic violence by reducing poverty, but also by reducing just the partner's presence at home. So unemployment is bad for everyone. It's good to have jobs and be employed.
So if it's good to have jobs, then what would seem to be the obvious solution to help young people into work would be providing access to these apprenticeships, vocational training. Why might this work, and might it work particularly well for some groups more than others?
Young people in developing countries have often not acquired many skills in schools.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
You've discussed this in your series itself, especially skills that can be directly used in the labor market. So skills training offers that intermediate opportunity to learn something specific like carpentry or plumbing in a short period so that it can result in a job. I think the youth will benefit the most from these programs, especially those with low opportunity cost of time, such as women or others who dropped out of high school or college, or those who do not learn much in school to start with and cannot pursue higher education due to constraints on time, credit, or both. Overall, skills training does an important job of facilitating that school-to-work transition in developing countries.
We tend to think about this as a government program. When I discuss it on Vox Dev Talks, as I have done in the past, it's been as a government program. Why so? Why is it not being provided by employers?
My sense is that costs are one of the big concerns in these countries. So material and infrastructure costs for providing technical training to teach some vocations may be too high for small employers to invest in. And almost all employers worry about high turnover. The fear that employees will leave as soon as they learn something useful, and especially if the most productive ones drop out, then it'll be a huge loss for the employer in terms of investment. Employers find it more practical to rely on external programs due to cost, resource constraints, and retention problems. And of course, there's also one other thing. There could also be just other constraints with launching training programs, which is, you know, maybe laws around education. I mean, what we hear about in the US, like it's one of the most regulated industries, education. So regulation is also limiting their desire to engage in training.
Existing research doesn't find that these apprenticeships are particularly successful. Why might they not be helpful? Common sense would suggest they would be very helpful.
Yes, it's true. I think Nehal talk a little bit more about this in terms of what our review brings in. But I will say a little bit about why apprenticeship in general may not be helpful. I think a lot of informal apprenticeships especially do not follow a set curriculum. So the lack of standardization, absence of certificates, and it focuses more on traditions rather than techniques in while imparting education.
Mm-hmm.
So the training often involves observing the master craftsman, you know, simply watching and replicating their actions. As a result, the quality of training is strongly correlated with the expertise of the master craftsman, motivation and commitment, which of course will lead to a lot of variance in the quality of training.
Mm-hmm.
And hence, not surprisingly, result variance in earnings, which would then, you know, look like a lot of what we've seen in the early studies, maybe null results. I think also that some of the apprenticeship training could not provide certificates, which further limits mobility among workers as they cannot signal their ability in the labor market. But I think it boils down to the quality of the training.
So let's have a look at what you discovered in your review. How many studies did you find? How many were you able to include in this review?
So we conduct a systematic review using 14 experimental studies that were implemented across 12 different countries. And these cover both published and working papers that have come out since the David McKenzie's 2017 review piece.
And when you were deciding what to include and what not to include, what criteria did you use? Which countries were you able to find studies from?
First of all, to be in our review, we needed the paper to be publicly available as of May 2021 in one of the major economic research platforms. This could be EconLit or Working Paper Series by IZA, NBER, or the World Bank. After that, we used a few additional filters to streamline our list of studies. So we only include studies that evaluate a skills training program, primarily those that impart some hard skills such as carpentry, welding, plumbing, beautician, seamstress, tailoring, and so on, or hard skills plus program where there is an add-on component which could be imparting soft skills or providing cash and job support. And these training programs were to be offered outside the existing school and college curriculum. Mm-hmm. We then also restricted ourselves to experimental evaluation of skills training programs, which is the gold standard for measuring program impacts. And it also makes it easier for us to pool impacts from various studies, eliminating any methodology-related differences that could be driving main results. As for the geographical spread, in our review, we have 7 studies from Africa, 3 from Southeast Asia, and 4 from Latin America. This is quite broad because if you compare it with the previous review, the 2017 review, there were 8 studies from Latin America, and 4 of them were only from Dominican Republic, and then 2 from Africa and 1 from India. So over time, the experimental evaluation of skills training programs has really expanded to several countries, which we are able to comment on in this review.
It's great that you can compare those studies from more locations, but of course you have to have some common impacts to compare. What were you looking at there?
We were primarily focused on 2 labor market outcomes that both economists and policymakers are interested in and are the first order outcomes of interest of any skills training program. These are whether the program improved employment and whether it improved earnings. We also look at hours worked, but these were available for fewer studies. And then we also go on and examine if these impacts vary over time or by the kind of training that's provided.
Okay, so first of all, the aggregate effect. What is the aggregate effect of all those programs on employment and on earnings?
When we combine the effects from individual studies in a meta-study analysis, the average impact on employment is positive, but relatively modest at about 5 percentage points, which is about a 10% increase in employment.
Mm-hmm.
When we go on and look at earnings, we find that there's an 11% increase in earnings. And these are overall impacts, which do not vary by time. So if we were to look at less than 6 months or more than 6 months, so in the short and the median run, they tend to be very similar. Even when we combine all the estimates that were available in the previous review with our review, the overall impact estimates remain almost unchanged. So we can conclude, and we do conclude in our review, that training opportunities improved employment and earnings for youth in low and middle income countries.
And is this across the board for all of the programs, or are particular types of programs more successful than others?
That's a great question and a really important one for this review. We classified all of these skills training programs into 3 different types. The first is the vocational training program, which focuses on imparting hard skills in a traditional classroom setup. The second one is the on-the-job training program, which follows the apprenticeship model, where individuals are paired with master craftsmen and they learn by doing stuff and observing. The final type offers sort of a mix of both classroom instruction plus an apprenticeship training program. The overall positive effects are almost entirely driven by vocational training programs. For instance, if you take earnings, in the vocational training programs, the treatment group experiences approximately a 25% increase in earnings over the control group. This is almost more than 3 times the returns to an additional year of schooling in low and middle income countries. So that's huge. On the other hand, if you look at on-the-job training and vocational plus on-the-job training programs, we find no positive effects. There is one example where we can compare the effects of these different types of programs from the same setting, and that's from a study by Alfonsi and co-authors in Uganda. And they reach similar conclusions as we do from our meta-analysis. So they have both vocational training and firm training in their analysis, and they find that those who had vocational training performed better than those who were trained by firms over time for both employment and earning outcomes.
Why is vocational training working so much better than these other methods?
That's a natural follow-up question, and we also wondered about that. We have a few conjectures as to why this could be the case. First is vocational training programs are designed to provide professional training through training institutes or NGOs that hire professional teachers to conduct training using a standard curriculum. And they often provide certificates upon completion.
Mm-hmm.
So the certifiability of vocational training skills could help workers take their skills elsewhere to another firm and to bounce back from any unemployment spells they might have. On the other hand, on-the-job training is provided by small entrepreneurs or master craftsmen who may not be qualified to impart the certifiable technical skills which trainee can take from firm to firm. And as Subha mentioned earlier, there might also be a lot of variability in the quality of trainers, commitment, motivation of trainers, which can increase the variability in the skills that are imparted and consequently, of course, in earnings. Also, on-the-job training programs rely on local craftsmen who are themselves working on low profit margins and may have fewer opportunities available to hire these newly minted trainees that are coming out.
As one further thing you set out to discover here, which was the impact for young women compared to young men from these training programs, was there a difference?
Most studies have both men and women in their evaluation sample and often report impact estimates for these two groups separately, which most researchers and policymakers are interested in. Surprisingly, however, only 5 studies in our review explicitly test for gender differences in the impact of skills training, and of these, only 3 studies find significantly different impacts for men and women. There's a study from Dominican Republic that finds that women have higher employment because of better soft skill acquisition as a result of the program. But then there's another study from Colombia that finds the exact opposite, that men have higher returns as they acquired better interpersonal skills. It's still an open question, and we really need more research to be able to say anything conclusive about these gender differentiated impacts of skill training programs.
A lot of economists are very skeptical about these types of programs. Are they correct to think that?
There has been some skepticism on the effectiveness of skills training programs.
Yes.
Due to the early null results. Yet over the years, you know, a lot of donor money and researcher effort has gone into both implementing and evaluating these programs, which is what motivated us to write this review. You know, look at all the new evidence and take stock of whether those early conclusions hold or not. And contrary to some prior conclusions, the new evidence we gather suggests that several skills training programs do pass the cost-effectiveness test. That's primarily owing to the relatively small program costs in these settings. So I think one has to bear in mind that it's coming from low program costs.
Subha, I'm going to make you into a policymaker in that case. Based on this new evidence then, what types of training or apprenticeship might both policymakers and economists be optimistic about, justifiably optimistic about?
We think vocational training programs can be effective in improving economic outcomes in urban areas, especially where the infrastructure for imparting skills training already exists and can be leveraged to implement these programs. However, in settings with limited infrastructure, we may have to focus on improving the quality of the apprenticeship training, you know, focus on maybe some sort of master craftsman professional development program or something like that, but also combine that with further support, you know, almost like a graduation program in the form of grants and capital to facilitate that transition from apprenticeship trainings to self-employment. But that means that there's going to be some variations in how these programs are implemented and where, which of course would then imply that some of these programs are going to be more costly than others.
So even if we implement more successful programs, can we definitely say that this would be the best use of resources if our ultimate goal is to increase employment?
I think that depends. Even if workers have the skills, of course, you know, lack of jobs or information frictions in the job market can still hinder workers' ability to find gainful employment. So in those markets, skill training will need to be complemented with wage subsidies for employers, soft skill training or career counseling and job placement assistance program, which can align the skills of the job seekers with the needs of the employer. I don't know if any of these are better. It depends on the setting. If there is no skill shortage and only an information friction problem, then placement assistance would provide the best returns.
So Subha, as policymaker here, what is your policy? How would you implement one of these programs? Who would you target?
What would be the ideal way to do this?
Yeah.
If we had that much power.
After VoxDev Talks, maybe one day you will.
there's a compelling case to implement vocational training program that imparts hard skills through a training institute with, of course, good teachers, and target these programs to high school dropouts, college dropouts, and unemployed vulnerable youths. We may also need to support those participants by providing them vouchers that cover transportation costs to increase program completion rates. Maybe even provide job assistance, at least initially, when workers lack labor market experience. The key would be to maintain the quality of instruction and implementation when scaling up these carefully designed experimental programs to result in sustained program impacts.
There is plenty of encouraging news in this work, so thank you very much for talking about it today. Thank you, Suba.
Thank you, Tim.
And Neha, thank you as well.
Thanks, Tim.
The chapter is called New Evidence on Vocational and Apprenticeship Training Programs in Developing Countries, and you've just been hearing from the two authors, Neha Agarwal and Suba Mani. It will be published in the Handbook of Experimental Development Economics. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find us there. If you like what you're hearing at Vox Dev Talks, then please tell others about it. And you can do that by leaving a review and rating us. And then they get to hear Vox Dev Talks as well.